How you doing?
My name is John Troche. I'm an alcoholic, and it's a pleasure to be back again. Last week we focused specifically on step one, and you know there's so much to get into as far as step one goes. Tonight we're going to be doing step two, but step two, it's hard to talk about step two without pointing back to step one. Because what we're talking about here is this idea of sanity, insanity. And I had a specific idea of what insanity meant before I came into AA. You know, like most people, I pictured the guy in a rubber room in a straitjacket. Like, that's insane. But they have a very specific way that they're using that term in this book. And it needed to be revealed to me. I needed, you know, again, this whole process is about good sponsorship. We really need, or at least my experience has been, I needed somebody that had an experience with this book, understood it, and could articulate it to me and help me to understand. I'm a guy that, what's really helpful for me is stories. Like, I like hearing, like, other people's, like, experience. I like pictures, I like analogies, metaphors. That's the stuff that really works for me and makes it come alive. And so a lot of times when I speak, I'll talk, you know, I will refer to my personal experience. I like to talk about, you know, analogies, metaphors, stories. So there'll be some of that tonight. And, you know, we'll be reading from the book. Let me start by going to page 44, We Agnostics, where they really start talking about what they mean by we came to believe a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And he says right at the beginning, in the preceding chapters, you've learned something of alcoholism. And, you know, last week I said, like, I had the experience of living, like, I lived the experience of being an alcoholic, but I didn't really understand what it meant to be an alcoholic. See, there were things that needed to be pointed out to me, and they pointed it out to me in this book. So we've learned something of alcoholism. We hope we've made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. And this is as simple as it gets for anybody. If when you honestly want to, you find you can't quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. Pretty simple. Pretty simple. And all I had to do was look at my own experience, and there was heaps of evidence that those two things were true in my life for a long time. He says, if that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Now, this is the thing I needed to wrap my mind around. And maybe that's even a bad way to say it, because my mind is part of the problem. But this is where I had to get to, is that I may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. What's going to get me there? What's going to get me to that place where I actually believe that? Because, and I work with people a lot, and I see the insanity at work all the time. And what I've come to see is that for each person, there is no substitute for your last drink. For each person, there's no substitute for having the crap beaten out of you. I mean, we are the people that we need to learn the hard way. It's very, very rare the alcoholic who can look at somebody else's experience and go, oh, okay, you're right, I'll do that. You know what I mean? We like to put up the fight. Maybe that's true for you, but I'm a little bit different. I'm a little bit smarter than you. I'm a better person than you. I think maybe there's a way I can do this. And we play this game a lot, and I saw myself playing this game. So how do I get to that place where I really see it? In the chapter before, more about alcoholism, we've all heard this a lot, they say that chapter could be called more about insanity, right? And it's like four parables in that chapter to really illustrate their point and what they mean by insanity. And over time, I began to see myself in each one of those stories vividly. You got the man of 30, you got Jim, you got Fred, and you got the jaywalker. And they're all in that chapter. And they're kind of like callbacks, too. Because, like, when we're in Doctor's Opinion, right, Dr. Silkworth talks about different categories of alcoholics. And he says, there's the type of man who's unwilling to admit he can't take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment. There's the type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. That's the man of 30. totally, right? There is there's the manic depressive type, who is perhaps least understood by his friends, and about whom a whole chapter could be written. And then there's this mythical being, I've never met this person. There are types entirely normal in every respect, except in the effect alcohol has upon them. They're often able, intelligent, friendly people. I'm still waiting to meet that guy. Still am. But I believe he's somewhere. So the man of 30, the guy who believes his long period of sobriety qualifies him to drink like other people. I had to check that box off too. And I talked about it last week, about drinking after 7 years sober and drinking after 3 years sober. You know, the man of 30, he says to himself, he goes, I want to be a success. I see that alcohol is a problem for me. And I want to be a success. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to stop drinking until I become a success. And then when I retire, then I'll drink like how I want to drink, because I won't have any more responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And he's able to do it. He's a rare person. He's a rare bird. And he does it. And I can only imagine, just based on my own experience, what it must have been like living with the man of 30 for those 25 years when he wasn't drinking and the drive for success was on. He must have been a nightmare. You know, that's untreated alcoholism. But so here's this guy, he's able to do it. And then that old idea is there. Look, you know, like I was sober for all this time. Obviously, it can't be that big of a problem. Carpet slippers come out, bottle comes out, he begins to drink, and he can't stop. And he's dead within 4 years. I mean, just a valuable lesson in that one. And I had to learn it for myself. His was 25 years, mine was 7. Right? But there was this insane thought that at some time in my life, I started to think, look at all the good stuff that's happened in my life. I was able to go back to school, get a career, have a daughter, pay my bills, go to work every day on time, which is a big deal for a guy like me. I mean, I was very erratic in all of those areas of my life. I could go shopping for food. I can do all these things that I never was able to do before. And the insanity was, well, look, you could do all that other stuff like a normal person. Maybe you can drink like a normal person. Maybe. And I had to, like I said, that box had to be checked, where I said, yep, that's true too. Doesn't matter how long I stay sober, if I start drinking again, it's going to be all the stuff that happened in the past and worse. That's my experience. So they talk about that. You have Jim. Jim, gotta love Jim. Jim is the guy who loses his automobile agency due to his drinking. And then when he's getting sober, he starts working at that place that he used to own. I mean, I just know how I would feel if I was Jim in that situation. Because the new owner, he doesn't know jack. You know, that's how I would think. And I kind of know what's going on. And really, don't tell me what to do. You know, I don't care if I'm working for you. In my mind, see, the problem is in my mind. And the problem was in Jim's mind. And Jim began the process of the steps, but never really progressed. He didn't enlarge his spiritual life. And when resentment really settled in on Jim, he found himself in a bar where he said, you know what? If I put a little whiskey in my milk, it can't hurt me on a full stomach. You know, and that's the insanity. See, he talks, when they lay out his story, as in Fred's, they talk about this thing called the mental blank spot, right? This mental twist. And what the mental blank spot looks like in my life is that there's a lot of evidence that alcohol and other substances, I don't mix well with them at all. When I start, I can't stop, and my life goes into the toilet, and it becomes the most important thing in my life to get that next drink. That's just my experience. And I have heaps of experience that points to that. And the mental blank spot is, even though I have all that experience and I know it, a day will come where all of a sudden all of that stuff just, it's gone. Like, it's not in my mind. It's just almost like I can't even access those memories, and something in me says, I should drink. Drinking is a good idea. Oh, I should definitely drink right now. Absolutely. It's the thing to do. And then I drink. And so what I saw was, when they talk about insanity, they're talking about, I have a mind that is not reliable in keeping me from a drink. Simple. I saw it. At certain times... See, there are times where, yeah, I'm nowhere near drinking because I don't want to, but not because I have power of choice, just because, like, I don't want to, and I'm doing this stuff, and it's just, I'm safe and protected. No problem. But there will be times, as they point out in this book, and as I saw in my life, there will be times where, you know what, I've just moved so far away from a spiritual solution, and I don't even know it. I'm just out there in the weeds. And that's the dangerous time for me. And then the day comes where my mind just does that thing, where it's just I can't access the problems that alcohol caused in my life, and I find myself drunk. So I had to see that. And it started making sense. Yeah, insanity. I get what they're talking about. I get this idea of insanity. They give the parable of the jaywalker, which I thought was the stupidest thing I'd ever read, probably the first 300 times I read it. I think it's just so dumb, you know? Here's a guy, he doesn't cross the street at the crosswalk? Like, come on. You know, that's so stupid, you know? And he keeps getting hit by cars and then, like, fire engines, and he gets out of the hospital, he promises people he's not going to cross the street in between, and he still keeps getting hit, and everybody's like, you're an idiot. Like, what an idiot. And I read it, and I'm like, what an idiot. And I would miss that part where it says, I know you think this is ridiculous, but if you substituted alcohol for jaywalking, it would fit exactly. And that's the point they're trying to make. Normal people look at us with what happens to us in our lives, and we continue to do it all, and they go, what's wrong with you? Why would you do that? And we go, I don't know. I'm going to try better next time. I'm going to try... Now I get it. Now I'm never going to do this again. And then next week we're doing it again. And people are just mystified by us. And that was the experience I started to see. So I work with a lot of people. So here's like some of the things I hear. Just recently I hear this one guy goes, you know what, I don't think, you know, all this stuff that you're describing, I don't have all these issues. I just like to get high and drink. Right? That's really what I like. It's really just that. And really, if I really pinpointed it, it's just because, like, when I'm bored, that's when I do it. And I go, well, okay, let's pretend that that's true. Right? Let's pretend that that's actually a real thing, that you just drink when you're bored, and that's your real problem. In light of everything that drinking and using does to your life, in what universe would drinking when you're bored make sense? Like, you were just homeless. This is a guy that was homeless. That's where it takes you, homelessness. And you're about 5 minutes away from homelessness, right? And this is what's in your head, that, well, I only do it when I'm bored. That's the insanity. Think about it. Think about what happens. Like, if you were able to really see what happens to your life when you do it, why would you ever pick up a drink again? Why? That's the insanity. And so we have to, each one of us, we have to see it in our own lives. We have to see that. And so he says, to one who feels he's an atheist or an agnostic, such an experience seems impossible. But to continue as he is means disaster, especially if he's an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. To be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. So here's the one that people like to point to is you got door number one and door number two. And behind door number one is a spiritual way of life. And behind door number two, you've got a doomed alcoholic death. And the alcoholic is the person that goes, what do you mean by doomed? Like, when you say doomed, like, what exactly does that mean? Like, it's even an option. You know what I mean? Like, normal people would be like, okay, spiritual way of life. I don't want to be doomed. And yet, we're the people that we're like, will I be dead by next Thursday? Because if I will be, if it's going to be a clean doom, then all right, I'll go with doom, you know? And it's really, like, that's an option. That's, like, what, like, how we see things. And what I started to see for myself is the reason why it's such a hard choice is because I can't pull off either one. I can't pull off doomed or a spiritual way of life. And my old ideas about what a spiritual way of life is I picture I'm going to have to be like a monk. I'm going to have to be like a refugee. I'm going to have to go out and like preach the word. I'm going to have to hand out flowers at the airport. I'm going to have to be a missionary and go to Africa. I'm going to have to be celibate. Like, this is all the stuff that's in my head on what they mean by a spiritual way of life. And it's just the garbage that I picked up over the years. It has nothing to do with nothing except it's stuff that's in my head. And that's really where they're getting at with this whole piece is my problem is all the stuff in my head. especially the things I think I know. I think I know a lot of stuff, and that stuff is blocking me from actually having an experience that they're talking about in here. So he says, it isn't so difficult. About half our original fellowship were of exactly that type, you know, people who were atheists and agnostics. At first, some of us tried to avoid the issue, hoping against hope we were not true alcoholics. But after a while, we had to face the fact that we must find a spiritual basis of life or else. And perhaps it's going to be that way with you, but cheer up. Something like half of us thought we were atheists or agnostics. Our experience shows that you need not be disconcerted. So we can start out in this position, and what we're looking at here is here are some exercises. I know you think that you're an atheist. Fine. You're an atheist. You're an agnostic. Fine. Let's just do some exercises and see if maybe our position can shift just a little bit. Let's see if we can open up just a tiny bit. Maybe when we talk about a higher power, maybe it doesn't have to be that thing that you think of in your head that, oh, it's that Judeo-Christian God that is like judging me, you know, that guy that he's going to get me. Maybe it doesn't have to be that. Maybe it can be something entirely different. Maybe it can be, I don't know, whatever you want it to be. Maybe it could be like, you know, the spirit of the universe. And that when we start to open ourselves up to these possibilities, we find out that this thing that we come with, being atheist and agnostic, it's a small hurdle. We can get past it. Now, this thing right here, this next part, we read it at my home group in our script. And it's like tattooed in my mind because it's really important to me. And he says, if a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. But we found that such codes and philosophies did not save us, no matter how much we tried. We could wish to be moral. We could wish to be philosophically comforted. In fact, we could will these things with all our might, but the needed power wasn't there. Our human resources, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed utterly. Now, he's talking about, and I found myself thinking this many times in my life. And I would see somebody, and they were a good, like, I could see this is a really good person. Like, I just, everything about this person shouted, that's a good person. Mm-hmm. And there was this thing in me that I was like, I would be like, man, I would love to be like Joe. You know, Joe is just a great guy. He does the right thing. It's like he intuitively knows what to do. You know what I mean? He doesn't even have to really think about it. Like, you can have a conversation with him, and it's like the right words just come right out of his mouth, and they're just comforting, and it's sweet, and it's nice, and he's just got this aura. And it would be apparent to me that that's what I'd like to be like Joe. I'd love to be like this guy over here. And I would even try to be like him. I would really like, I'm going to, you know, and they're saying, a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life. Let's be like Joe. That's a mere code of morals. It's a better philosophy. I want to be like him. I just want to do the next right thing. And what I would find is I would find such frustration with the fact that no matter how much I wanted to be like this guy who was so great, I just couldn't pull it off. I just couldn't do it. On my own power, I couldn't do it. And that's the frustrating part of this. And that's what they're pointing to. Next thing he says is lack of power. That was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be about a power greater than ourselves, obviously, but where and how are we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. See, I don't solve my problem. The power solves the problem. My job is to plug into the power. If I can plug into the power is going to solve the problem. In my mind, I thought, I'm going to find a way to manage my life and get my ducks in a row and make everything go the way I want it to go. And that's not what they're saying. They're saying, if you can plug into a power, that power is going to solve your problem, not you. Wow. That kind of was like a game changer for me. Because it's not about my thinking. It's not about my thoughts. It's not about me figuring out the world and being able to, if I could just manage well, you know, if I could just get people to do the things I wanted, and I've been trying to do that my whole life, and I couldn't figure out why it didn't work, and I couldn't figure out why I was not satisfied, you know? And we talk about in this book, and we're going to get into it in this chapter, about the bedevilment, about just being like restless, irritable, discontent, easily annoyed, never satisfied. Shit bothers me. I get very upset, and I can't tell you why. And that annoys me. It annoys me that I get so upset about things I can't even tell you why. Right? There's a problem. What they're saying is, my problem is lack of power. I don't have the power to make my life go the way I'd like it to go. Very interesting. So there's this concept I love to talk about when I talk about insanity. There's this awesome speaker from San Francisco. His name is Paul H. And Paul was the guy who I first heard this from, and it was this amazing analogy, and I got it immediately. And I talk about it as much as I can. And so basically, he presented it like alcoholism and addiction behaves very much like a parasite. And I'm not saying that it is a parasite. I'm saying that it behaves like a parasite. So the analogy is this, right? There are parasites in the world that do all kinds of things. And we can see what it does. So there's one in particular. It's called toxo. And toxo really thrives in the belly of a cat. That's really where it wants to be. It's a perfect environment for it to reproduce and live and grow, and it enjoys the belly of a cat. But toxo finds itself in lots of different creatures. And toxo will find itself in a rat or a mouse. And this is what's so clever about toxo, this parasite. What it will do when it's in a rat is it will hack into the rat's brain, right? And it will tell the rat, it will say, when you see a cat, you go right up to that cat. Go right up to him. Now, here's the deal, right? All living things, right, we all have this one thing in common. We have this natural instinct for survival, right? And a rat, millions of years of evolution, they know cat, run. Stay away from a cat. Cat's bad news. But see, this parasite, it's so clever. It's hacked into the brain of this rat, and it says to the rat, no, go up to the cat. And I bet you when that rat, and you can actually go on YouTube and see this, like rats that are sick with toxo, and you'll see them go right up to the cat's almost shocked, like, oh my God, free lunch, you know? And so I bet you when this happens, right, when that sick rat with toxo in its brain goes up to the cat, I bet you on some level that rat's going, yeah, this is my idea. I'm making a choice. I'm going up to that cat, mm-hmm. right? See, the thing is hacked into its brain, and it's going against its own instinct for self-preservation. Now, if you take a look at what happens to us and what we do, it's not really much different, right? We have this thing called alcoholism. If you're an alcoholic or an addict, you have this thing, right? And it is hacked into your brain. And it tells you to do things that if you were sane, if you were a normal person, you would never do. Look at all the places you ended up. Look at this. No matter your age, sex, orientation, race, doesn't matter. Alcoholics and addicts, we all end up in the same three parking spots. Jails, institutions, and death. It's where we end up. Why? We're all ending up in front of those same cats. The same cat, that thing that hacks into my brain and says, go there. Go do this thing that goes contrary to everything in you that says, don't do it. There's another analogy that they use in this book about the hot stove. Right? It's like, let's say there's a stove in that kitchen. Let's turn it on, and I'm going to offer you some money. And I'm going to say, I'll give you this money, and you got to go in there, and you got to hold your hand on that hot stove and burn your hand to the bone. And I'll give you money. I'll give you a lot of money to do it. That's the deal. You got to hold your hand to that stove and burn it to the bone. Now, even if I could convince you that that was something you'd want to do, and you really thought, well, I really need the money, let me go do this, right? You put your hand on that stove, there is something inside you, it's a natural instinct, you don't even have to think about it, that you just jump away from that flame. See, your body knows, like, don't, no, and you flinch. You can't, I'd have to tie you there and to keep your hand on there, to burn it to the bone, right? Now think about the way alcoholism works. What you do when you keep going out, it's like you keep putting your hand on that stove and burning it to the bone. Even worse, Look at all of the things that have happened as a result of your drinking. And this is how it had to be laid out to me as I looked over the carnage of my life. Look at what I did. Look at the relationships I lost. Look at the relationships I gave away. Look at the people I harmed. Look at the, you know, property, prestige, whatever it is. Cars, gone. Done. And it's over and over and over again. And the insanity is I keep doing this, and there's this part of me that I can't get it. I don't understand. Why does this keep happening to me? Why am I so unlucky? Why are people victimizing me? Why am I a victim of circumstance? Like, this is the stuff that I'm not getting it over and over and over again. And that's what they paint in this book, and I started to see it. If you go to, let's see. I mean, let's go for it. Let's go right to page 52 and look at the bedevilments. Right? Page 52. We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. Now, you can experience that in the depths of active alcoholism, and you can also experience that without a drink in your body. Right? This hopelessness, this thing where you're in a ditch and you're just spinning your wheels and you just can't get out. No matter how much you try. No matter how hard you try, no matter how much you say, let me just sit here and think about this and figure this thing out. No matter how much you do that, you can't seem to avoid this pitfall that you're in. Right? And that's the problem of sobriety. Is how am I going to stay sober if when I'm sober, that's how I feel? How am I going to stay sober when I don't have a drink, I experience the four horsemen. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, despair. How am I going to stay sober? Like, why would I? Why would I? My wiring is all messed up when it comes to alcohol and other substances. Because here's the insanity, and it goes back to this thing where I act against my own best interest. Okay? I know it's insane what's happening to me in my life, like the stuff that happens. But yet, I can't escape the fact that my life is just so unbelievably disappointing and desperate and awful if I don't have a drink. Because on some level, the drink at least does something. I'm looking for some kind of relief. And I don't even know that I'm doing that. I don't even realize it. So, here's the problem. I have all this stuff going on, and now AA says to me, well, the solution to that problem is this higher power, which we call God. And, you know, that's going to be really hard for you since, you know, you're an atheist and an agnostic. And we hear people talk about their religious beliefs and their spiritual practices and all this stuff. And it's a difficult thing for us to get around. Okay, so now we get to the point where I see this. I see the truth that I am insane in a very real way when it comes to what I'm doing. I see it. But I can't escape the fact that I don't believe that any kind of God is going to do anything for me. I don't believe it. Look at the world we live in, right? Look at what's happening. In Bill's story, he talks about the burning and chicanery, right? Bill goes off to war and he sees the hell of war and he lives it. And how could you believe in a God? A God could have anything to do with us when that kind of stuff goes on? How can you believe that there's any kind of God at all when some maniac goes into a school and just starts shooting people, right? How can you believe that there's any kind of God when there's people in the world, they're starving, they're being victimized, they're being abused? How could you believe in anything like that? You are so naive and pathetic if you really believe that there's something that has anything to do with any of this stuff. And I can understand being at that place because I've been there. I remember thinking at one point, if there is a God, he is a sick, sick man. He's watching and laughing. He's just got me. And he wants to see me suffer. Mm-hmm. Like, these were my ideas about what, you know, this thing was. So, I'm in a bind. I'm in a pickle. Right? How do I get out of this? Well, there are well, let me see. There's Christopher Columbus, there's Galileo, and there's the Wright brothers, right? In this chapter, in We Agnostics. And I remember for a long time I would read this and I'd go, why is he talking about them? Like, what does that have to do with anything? What does Christopher Columbus or the Wright brothers or Galileo have to do with, like, what he's talking about? And a sponsor started to point it out to me, like, so let's think about the world before the Wright brothers, when everybody knew that man can't fly. I mean, everybody knew it, right? It was common knowledge, man can't fly. And then these two nudniks, they go, well, I think man can fly. And I think we're gonna build a machine and we're gonna fly. And people are like, you're idiots. You're so stupid. That's just ridiculous. You're gonna kill yourself. Right? And what happened? They built this machine and they flew. And not very high and not very far, but they got off the ground. They flew. And they proved that it was possible. And you know what that did? It changed the world. I mean, think about this. Think about this. The last vacation you went on, the last place you went to that you got into an airplane with a bunch of strangers and flew, and what would take days or months to get to a place took you hours. Changed the world. Think about when we lived in a world where everybody agreed the earth is flat. We live in a flat earth, guys, and everybody knows it. And some nudnik comes around and he says, I don't think so. I think maybe it's round. I think if I sail east, I can go west. Or if I sail west, I can go east. I think I'll come back around. And you know what people would say? They'd say, you're a moron. If you don't get killed by some sea monster before you get to the edge of the earth, you're going to go right off the edge and we'll never see you again. And that was common knowledge. Everybody knew it. And it took somebody to first have the idea that it's possible. But the more important thing was after they had the idea that it was possible to follow it up with action. Because if you don't follow it up with action, it doesn't mean much. I'm sure there are plenty of people in the old world that believed, hey, maybe the world is flat, but I mean maybe it's round, but they weren't gonna bet their life on it, you know. You needed somebody that would do it. So they put that in this book because all of these examples are examples of ideas that changed the world, right? We went from a flat earth to a round world. We went from the universe revolved around us to we revolve around the sun, to we are just an insignificant little part of our galaxy, right? See, like our perspective changed, and it changed the world. So they're all million-dollar ideas. So what's the million-dollar idea for us? That idea is the fact that I can get access to a power greater than myself, and that power could change my life. That's a million-dollar idea. That spiritual principles could solve all my problems. That's a million-dollar idea. Because if you could get with that idea and really use it and really access it, imagine how different your life would be. For anybody in here who's new or just coming back, imagine what your life could be like if you weren't constantly relapsing. If you weren't, basically a plaything for your addiction and your alcoholism. Imagine what your life could be like. And all you have to do, and this is what's beautiful about this program, is you're in a room where there are people who suffer just like you. And they are not suffering like that anymore. That's the key. See, I'm not telling you this thing like, oh yeah, no, it's definitely a round world, but I never sailed there. I'm telling you, as a guy who sailed, I sailed east and came around west. And I can tell you that it's real. And there's other people in this room that did the same thing. And that's like the beauty of this thing. So they present the concept of the power of an idea. And the power of an idea is it can keep you locked up in chains and caged. Or you can have an idea that sets you free. That's up to you. What do you believe in? What are you living your life based on? What are the ideas in your life that you live, that you totally know it's true? So if we go back to the back of the book, and we go to the spiritual experience, there's some really important stuff in there. And he says the terms, and this is on page 567 in the fourth edition, he says the terms spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. They give us, there's four terms that are kind of interchangeable in this book. They talk about a spiritual awakening, a spiritual experience. In the doctor's opinion, he talks about a psychic change. And here, they talk about a personality change sufficient to recover from alcoholism. All four of those terms are more or less the same thing. It's about a change. Something happens. We change the way we see the world. But not we. We don't do it for ourselves. We have this experience that changes the way we see the world. Right? Personality change sufficient to recover. Imagine your personality could be changed. I didn't believe that. I believe that your personality was formed when you were like 4 years old. And it never changed from that point on. You are who you are, and it's never going to change. You can't change the spots on a dog. Can't do it. Nope. Can't teach an old dog new tricks. I believe that one, too. So there's all these things in my head. I believe that. I don't even know I believe them. I just believe them. And this process is about, let's find out what we believe. Let's find out what our limiting beliefs are. So in the first few chapters... All right, so in the first few chapters, a number of sudden The next paragraph. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, and that's change, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he's undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource, which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. That is such an interesting way to put it. An unsuspected inner resource. I didn't think I had any inner resource, really, to tell you the truth. There's another part in this book where he talks about we found the great reality deep down within ourselves. In the final analysis, it's only there that God or spirituality can be found, deep down within ourselves. Fascinating. I used to have this idea of there's me here on earth, and if there's a God, he's up there in heaven doing his God stuff. And I'm down here doing my John stuff, and never the twain shall meet. You know what I mean? Maybe on some future date, we will meet, and he's going to yell at me for a lot of stuff, but we'll put that off for as long as we can. Right? My idea of spirituality was we're separate from each other. The way that they put this here doesn't sound like we're separate from each other at all. It sounds like when he says... And I would read that, and I would kind of think, like, I don't really think he means that. Like, I don't think he really means when he wrote, we found the great reality deep down within ourselves, I thought, I don't think he really means that. And then after, as time went by, I started to go, I think he really means that. I think he means the great reality deep down. And here's the thing. If that's true, if the great reality is deep down within me, and it's also deep down within you, and there's an unsuspected inner resource within me, and there's an unsuspected inner resource within you. If there's something inside of us, right, maybe we're connected in a way that I never, ever even suspected. That's really, truly profound, that I could never get with my mind. Maybe what we are is unbelievably connected in a great way. But see, the problem is we have these minds that tell us that stuff. That's not true. You know, there's me and there's you. There's us and there's them. You know, let's fight. let's just burn this thing down because I don't agree with you. And so this is already, just reading some of this stuff, it's shifting the way I see what's possible. Unsuspected inner resource. Maybe I don't have to find this thing that's way out there. Maybe I have to look within. Maybe that's what they meant when they said it's an inside job. Maybe. So most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. So there's three things that are, I need them. I have to have them. Willingness, honesty, open-mindedness. Now, how open is my mind if every time you say the word God, I'm like, ah, don't talk about God. I don't want to hear that, you know? Find a way to open up my mind. Find a way to be able to tolerate what you have to say. Find a way to connect with what you guys are talking about. See it from my own experience. The willingness is about, okay, I'll try. I will try. The honesty is about, can I be honest with myself about what I really believe and what I really think? The truth is, for a very long time in my life, I could not be honest with myself. When they talk about delusion, they talk about, I believe a lie. I believe that something that's not true. And I had a lot of delusional thoughts about myself, this world, you, what it all means. And they weren't helpful. They were limiting thoughts. The very end of this, he says, there's a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. Herbert Spencer. Mm-hmm. Right? So, does anybody in here know what's the mating call of the alcoholic? I know. Yes, but, I know. I know, yeah, but, I know. I know. I can't tell you how many things I knew. I knew everything. And you would tell me something, and you know my answer? I know. Dude, I know. That's my whole life is I know. There was this thing that they would say, and they still say it today, about would you rather be right or would you rather be happy? Mm-hmm. And the wise asses in the room say, I want both. I want to be right and happy. Mm-hmm. All right? But really, think about it. Do I want to be right? How many times have I fought to the bitter end? I'm miserable about this thing, but I have to be right. This thing is saying, is it possible you've been wrong about all this stuff you've been thinking all your life? Is it possible? Can you even open yourself up to the possibility you might have been wrong? How about that? Maybe if you find out you were wrong all this time and you could admit it, maybe you'll finally be happy. Maybe. You ever consider that? These are all things, they're all new concepts for me to consider. So then they talk about in this book, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. Spiritual awakening, spiritual experience. So I've had both. I've had the experience and I've had the awakening. I'll tell you about both of them. The experience, the spiritual experience happened for me at my third AA meeting. My third AA meeting, I had gone to two before. Okay, I have a DWI or DUI, whatever it was, and I'm in drinker driver class, right? The first class I go to, by the way, I drink before I go to the class, right? Because I'm like, you know, it was at a weird time in the day, you know what I mean? And it was like, I'm so uncomfortable, and I'm like, I just want to take the edge off. Now, I'm not stupid, and I think that's a really dumb idea to drink before you go to your drinker driver class. But my brain, my insanity, that thing starts saying, yeah, but you know what? Just take the edge off. You don't have to get drunk. You know what I mean? Like, it's going to be stressful. You know, you got to go to this drinker driver class. Like, that sucks. You know, just a little bit. And, you know, and I told you last week, I talked to myself, and I'm like, you know what you'll do? You just have a few. You'll brush your teeth really good. You'll put on some cologne, and you'll go to your class. And I was like, yeah, it's a good idea. You know, like, I think that'll work. That'll do. And that's what I did. And I go to my drinker driver class. And at the end of the class, the facilitator says, we're not going to do anything this week, but if it happens again, it's going to be a problem. Somebody in here was drinking tonight and does not fly in here. And I'm sitting there going, oh, my God, like, what's wrong with me? Like, why would I? That's so stupid. That's such a stupid thing to do. Like, I drove to my drinker driver class. You know what I mean? Like, I drove there. I wasn't, like, dropped off. I drove there drinking. Like, it's just dumb. It's a stupid thing to do. So, I'm a mess. And I go, and I have to go to these AA meetings to kind of, you know, I have to go along to get along, and I have to go to these AA meetings. I have to go to six and get the thing signed. So I go to my first two. I get there late. I leave. You know, as soon as it's over, I get my thing signed, and I run out, and I hated it. I thought AA was just ridiculous. This is so stupid. You know, like, you people are so dumb. I hate you. I just hate you. I just knew I hated you right off the bat. I didn't know any of you, but I hated you. And my third meeting, this is where I have the spiritual experience. I'm driving. I'm in my car. And I realized, I look at the time, and I knew that if I went home first, I would, like, be really late for this meeting. So I might as well just get there early, right? And I'll go and I'll sit and I'll read. Now, I don't know anything really about AA. Like, I don't know people come early. Like, I'm expecting the place is going to be empty and I'll just sit and, you know, sit somewhere and just read my book and wait for this dumb meeting to start. But I get there and there's, like, people hanging out outside of the meeting. I'm like, what the hell is going on here? So I go to walk in, and as I go to walk in, right, this is the AA is so beautiful, such a beautiful thing. As I go to walk in, and I didn't know this, but this girl, her job was she was the greeter. I didn't know that. And as I go to walk past her, she puts her hand out and says, welcome. Now that got my attention, because the truth was, at that point in my life, nobody was welcoming me anywhere. People were like, even if they weren't saying it to me, I could read their mind, and they were saying, get out of here. Right? She said, welcome. Wow. Okay, maybe AA's not as bad as I thought it was. Okay. So she, and then, I'm going to, like, walk past her, and she goes, are you new? Now, we're, like, such insane people, right? Because in my mind, I say to myself, well, I've been to two meetings already, so I guess I'm not really, like, I'm not new, like, you know. It's so, like, we're just, like, the insanity is just so funny. So, like, I go, like, well, you know, this is, like, my third, and then she goes, do you have a sponsor? Now, I'm about to go into my whole spiel about how I'm never going to get a sponsor. If I do get a sponsor, by the way, it will be a woman. Like, I'll get a woman sponsor, but I'm never getting a man. Like, it's not going to happen. And I'm about to go into my whole spiel. I go, no, and I'm about to say more. And all of a sudden, I hear a voice over my shoulder go, well, you got one now. And I'm like, what? So I turn around, and there's this guy. His name was Johnny. Hey, how are you? Blah, blah, blah. Come on. He says to me, hey, you got a big book? And I go, is that a Bible? Right? And he goes, his answer was, no, that's the big book. Come on, kid, I'll get you a big book. And we go downstairs, and he gives me my first big book. I'm like, all right, so I got welcomed, and somebody's giving me a gift. Okay, all right. Now, you know, and they're softening me up. You know what I mean? Like, I see what's happening, you know? All right, I'll play along. So he's doing his thing, and he goes, I'm sure many of you have heard the same question. And he lays it out to me. And he goes, are you willing to go to any lengths to get sober? To which I tell my first lie in AA. Yeah, of course I am. Now, I am not willing to go to any lengths at all. I'm not interested in sobriety. I'm only here because I'm in trouble. Right? That's the only reason why I'm here. But see, I intuitively knew that he was, you know, he might have had some kind of answer. You know, I could just tell there was something about this guy. He might have some kind of answer. And if I tell him the truth that, no, I'm not really, you know, willing, he's not going to tell me whatever secret he's about to tell me. So let me play along. And that's what I did my whole life. I'll play along. Hum a few lines. I'll fill in the rest. So he goes, and this is the thing that got me. He goes, listen, when this meeting starts, you don't have to say anything. You don't have to do anything. He goes, but I'll make one suggestion. Try to have an open mind, like it says in here, one of the requirements, right? Try and have an open mind and listen to what these people have to say. Now, when he said, I'm going to make one suggestion, I'm like, all right, here it comes. You know, he's going to tell me to do something stupid that I'm never going to do, you know? Like, I'm bracing myself for, like, what is it going to be? And it was, like, so simple what he was, like, suggesting. And it was one of those things where I felt like, it was like one of those moments where I felt like I really heard somebody, like for the first time almost. Like, just sit there and just try and keep an open mind and listen to these losers? Okay, I can do that. Sure, that's easy, that's simple, fine. I go into the meeting, I sit down, meeting begins. Now, my first two meetings, when the meeting was going on and people were talking,
They sounded like they were talking with their hand over their mouth. It was very muffled, and I had no idea what they were talking about.
And it sounded like, to me, that they were just whiners, and they're complaining about their lives, and they were losers. That's what it sounded like, not interested. But now, this time, at my third meeting, as I'm sitting there, I hear them very clearly and very loudly, and like, I'm hearing people go, yeah, you know what, I couldn't stop drinking, and I came here to AA, and I got, you know, I found this power greater than myself, and my life has totally changed, and like, I feel great, and like variations on that kind of theme, like of people that had found some kind of solution, and I hear them talking about God. Now, at this point in my life, the first time I came into AA, I had been opened up to God. I'd been opened up to God only because my life was so bad that I figured the only thing I have left is prayer. I just started praying. And I started reading a book, and the book was called How to Find God. You know, I'm looking for something. I'm grasping at straws. And I'm really, at that point in my life, I'm hoping that there's some kind of God that can do something for me. Let's make a deal. Right? So I had been praying for like maybe 3 weeks, maybe a month. And my life was getting worse, not better. And I was like, this prayer thing doesn't really work. Because, like, where are you, God? Right? So now I'm sitting in this meeting, and I'm hearing these people say this. And I'm thinking, wait a second, I've been praying, you know? Like, I've been praying to God, you know? And these people are kind of talking about God. And then I go and I read this. I see the shades on the wall, and I start reading them. And I'm going, wait. God and God. And I see God as you understand him, and God and God. And I'm sitting there and I'm going, I didn't know AA was about God, right? And I'm sitting there and I'm going, I didn't know anything about AA. I thought I knew everything. I thought this was Loserville. This was a bunch of whiners. This is the last place I'd ever want to be. I already knew the answer. So when I already knew the answer, there was no room for new information. But now as I'm sitting there and I'm reading this, now all of a sudden new information's coming. I'm going, AA's about God? And these people are talking about God? And then I start thinking about, you know, I've been praying for like a while, you know. And now here's the thing that happened. This is the spiritual experience. I'm sitting in the meeting, and as all of this is like unfolding, literally it was like the room was getting brighter. And then I started getting this really spooky feeling. Because here's the thing. When I was praying all that time, and you know, and I realized it in the moment, what I really was asking for, like I was asking for like a new relationship. You know, like, God, can you put a new girl in my life? Or can I get a windfall of money? Like, I could really use money right now. Preferably both. Can I get both those things? Like, that would really help me out, like, right now, because I'm really depressed about my life and things are not going well. So relationship and money in that order, please, quickly. Like, that's kind of what I'm thinking. And now I'm sitting in this meeting and I'm having this experience and I realize this. And all of a sudden, this thought comes over me, and I go, all that time that I had been praying, I had been praying to something, and whatever that thing is, it's there, and it heard my prayers, and this is the answer to those prayers. And I knew immediately, and it took no effort at all. I knew right then and there, if I keep coming to AA, I'm going to be okay. And it was literally like, just the weight of the world went right off of me. And I'm sitting in the back of this meeting, and I almost start laughing because this is like absurd. Like, this is not how I pictured my evening going at all. You know what I mean? This is, I didn't consider something like this was going to happen. And I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. This is the place. There's a song by Bob Marley. It's Three Little Birds. Right? And he says, don't worry about a thing. Every little thing's going to be all right. And I'm hearing those words in my mind. Every little thing's going to be all right. I'm okay. You're okay, dude. Keep coming here. You're going to be okay. And that thing changed my life that night. Spiritual experience. Now, spiritual experience all by itself means nothing if you don't follow it up with action. If you don't maintain and grow your spiritual life. And, you know, my first time in AA, like I told you last week, 7 years, 5 of those 7 years were amazing. I had an unbelievable rock star experience in AA when I was working these steps and living this way of life and living by spiritual principles. Unbelievable. And when I stopped, because I had to prove to myself that, you know what, I still have it, and I stopped working this program, slowly but surely I was getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And just like it says in the book, when we harbor resentment, We shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit. The insanity returns, and we drink again. And for us, to drink is to die. The insanity returns. The solution that I found in AA deals with that sanity, deals with that thing between my left and right ear that will tell me periodically, it's always been this way, it's never going to be any other way than this, it's just awful, you should drink, what would it matter if you drank? All the just insane stuff that the insanity will tell you. And if you stick around AA long enough, you will hear everything under the sun of like insane things that people have thought and drank on. Oh, I thought this, I thought that. That was the spiritual experience. The spiritual awakening, when they talk about sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, my last time, when I came back to AA in 2007, it was and by the way, that first time, the obsession to drink was lifted that night. It literally, it was just like, boom, gone. Unbelievable. It was like a miracle. It was a miracle. The last time I come back to AA, every day I am living with the insanity, and it's like, it's driving me insane. It's driving me crazy. Like, it's literally driving me crazy. Like, I wake up, and as soon as I open my eyes, I'm like crazy as a bed bug. I'm just like, oh, I want to rip my skin off, and I have this thought that says, you have like a week, dude. If you relapse today, what's the big deal if you lose a week? You've lost 7 years. You've lost 3 years. What does it matter if you lose a week? Do it, 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 do it now, do it. And I'm like, shut up. You know, and this is like, 1 minute awake. You know what I mean? Like, this is not going well, right? So I'm insane. I'm crazy. And I'm going, and here's the only thing I had going for me at that time in my life, in 2007, coming back to AA, the only thing that I had better than a newcomer is I knew for a fact that it was possible to be comfortable and not drink and use drugs. I knew that because I had lived it, right? And that's what I was hanging everything on, that I could get that back. But right next to that feeling was this thought that, oh my God, what if I've done so much damage to myself that I'm never going to get that back? Like, what if this, what I'm experiencing right now, that thing is what sobriety is going to be for the rest of my life? That is a horrifying thought. And I got to tell you, if that was the truth, if that's what sobriety was going to be, that insanity, that voice driving me to do the wrong thing, I mean, just give me a bullet, man. Just end it, really. And I'd rather be dead than live like that. Okay, so now, here I am, every day, this is what my life looks like in AA, the 2007. I wake up. I'm insane. I go to the gym because why not? You know, I'll just go to the gym. And maybe I'll exercise the demons that way. I go to the gym, then I go to work. Lucky enough to still have a job. I'm a mess at my job. They hate me. They want to fire me so bad because I am the worst employee, but I still have this job. And so I have 8 hours of my day accounted for. Great. As soon as work is over, I go home. And this is like Groundhog's Day. This is like every day for me. As soon as work is over, I go home and I just crash for about an hour and a half. I'm just dead asleep. I wake up, I get ready, and I go to the meeting. I meet up with my sober buddies. And then after the meeting, we either go to the diner or we go to somebody's apartment and play Scrabble or we go to the movies or we do something. Some kind of fellowship. And they are basically, for the most part, babysitting me. I mean, I'm a man, and I need a babysitter because I'm insane, and I need it. Like, I recognize it now. I recognized it back then. I need like supervision, big time, and I'm going insane, and it's every day. And I'm going, I'm going like this. I'm just marking days. It's like a prison sentence. I'm just marking days, and I'm going. Every time I get to the end of the day, I'm excited to get to go to sleep because I feel like I'm one day closer to maybe feeling normal again. Maybe. Right? This is what's going on. And I can't even tell you how long that's going on. I mean, literally, it was way longer than I wanted it to be. Okay. One day, fast forward, I don't even know how long it was. One day I'm at a meeting, right? And like literally, I couldn't smile. I was like, oh, I'm so angry. So one day I'm at a meeting, and I hear somebody say, I can't even tell you what they said. And I start laughing. and I'm smiling. And I think they said something about, I think what they actually said was something like, you know what, like some days, like I feel good and I don't even have any right to really feel good, but I do and I don't know why, it's hard to explain and I identified with that. You know, like I don't really have any right or reason to feel good at all because, you know, my life has not been going well for a long time, but you know what, yeah, I feel pretty good. Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting in the chair in this AA meeting and I start thinking about it, I go, wow, I do feel good, man. I actually feel great. And then I start going, geez, how long has this been going on for? You know, like, this has actually been happening for a while. You know, and now I'm thinking, I'm like, well, when did it start? You know, I couldn't tell you when it happened, right? Just like in here where it says, you know, the friends of the newcomer notice before he does. I couldn't tell you when it started to happen. I just knew it's been like this for a long time. I couldn't tell you when it was the last time I had that thought that said, and I really miss drinking and getting high. And I feel like I'm missing out. And I wish I could do it. Like, I couldn't remember the last time I had that thought. And that was like a daily thought with me every single day. And that was miraculous. I was like, oh my God. So that was like, for me, the spiritual awakening of getting to the other side of obsession being removed. Now, again, spiritual experience, spiritual awakening, it doesn't matter if you don't continue on, whichever one you have, if you don't continue on with this thing and live by spiritual principles, my experience, it's only my experience, if you don't continue on with it, it's just temporary. It's a temporary thing. I need to continue. Because really, my problem, although I've always thought my problem was out there, and I especially thought my problem was you people, like you, you sons of bitches, like you are constantly, if you would just leave me alone, I'd be okay, right? I always thought it was you, it was circumstance, it was this, it was the DMV, it was the NYPD, it was, you know, lawyers, it was judges, it was politicians, it was, you know, always something that I could point my finger at. And what I came to see is that my problem is not any of those things. It's what's in here. It's my mind. It's the way I see the world. And I need a solution for that. And that's what the solution did for me. Came to believe implies a process happens. And that's been my experience. A process happened where it was like this chiseling away. It's a chiseling away. And, you know, just one day. And I remember the last thing I'll say before I end is we have these big book meetings up by me. We're big book, you know, enthusiasts. And we love to talk about this stuff to death. And, you know, really hone in on certain words and things. And so I remember one time we're having this debate or conversation or discussion about how do you know when you've had the spiritual experience? How do you know? Right? I remember my friend Elizabeth bringing that one up. How do you know? Like, how do you know you've had it? And that one played in my mind for, you know, that night. It's playing in my mind. And I just remember I'm walking, at that point I lived in this apartment building, and I'm walking to the front door, and I put the key in, and I go through, and it's just like, man, my life is like, I'm blessed. I am, I feel that, you know what I mean? That's not just something I say, like, because I think that sounds good, but it's like this, it's a reality, like, I feel that. I am blessed. Oh my God, I am so blessed. Oh my God, there are so many good things in my life. See, what do I focus on? I focus on the good stuff. Does it mean that things... Yeah, sure, things happen. Things that we don't like. Yeah, it happens. But like, I'm not focused on that stuff. I'm focused on like, oh my God, look at what I have in my life. Look at all the good people that are there. Look at who I can speak to, the support I get, the relationship that I have with God. A relationship implies both ways, right? I need God, and God needs my cooperation. And, you know, like I like to say, God as I understand him, for any of my atheist friends, whatever that means to you, right? For me, it just makes more sense to say God than to say this long form all the time, right? And it's just a spiritual way of life. Came to believe a power greater than myself, this thing that I call God, could restore me to sanity. And later on in the steps, when we get to step 10, they're going to talk about at that point, what it is, what it means to be restored to sanity, what that looks like in your life. And it's not about the crazy things we do when we drink, because the most insane thing I will ever do is pick up a drink completely 100% sober. That's insane. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you.